Hello, everyone, and welcome to Crossroads, the infrastructure podcast. I'm Infralogic's Managing Editor for the Americas, Jonathan Carmody, and I'm delighted to welcome to the studio today, Emil Henry, founder and CEO of Tiger Infrastructure Partners. Emil, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and it's great to be here and good to see you again.
See you too. Tiger Infrastructure Partners was founded in 2010. They have three funds to date and have raised successful capital and deployed across many different sectors in the industry. The fund focuses on three areas: digital infrastructure, energy transition, and transportation assets. So Emil, tell us a little bit about the strategy and the ethos of Tiger Infrastructure Partners when it comes to middle market investing.
Tiger, we have been called a pioneer. We've been called innovative. And I think the main reason for that is that we were the first growth infrastructure fund complex in the infrastructure firmament. All of my investors know the original insight for Tiger came from this. My senior partners and I were at Lehman Brothers when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt. And we decided to spin out to start our own firm. But in doing that, you know, God closes one door, he opens another door. We had the opportunity really to look at infrastructure investing as a white canvas and what might we do. And the original thesis for Tiger was that there was this wide open, massive addressable market, which none of the infrastructure players were addressing. And suffice to say that it is growth and value add and higher return than what it existed at the time. And we knew this to be the case, but the world had yet to embrace, this is back in 2010-11, the world had yet to embrace growth infrastructure. Actually, my partners and I, we were a little tortured up at the time in, you know, what do we call it? Because there was no growth fund. LPs had heard of such a beast, and we thought we might confuse them if we went out of it with something called growth. At the end of the day, we looked at ourselves and we said, you know what? Let's call it what it is. It is growth. It's incredibly exciting. And let's go after it, calling it growth.
Emil, you founded Tiger Infrastructure Partners in 2010, very much with a growth mentality or a growth ethos. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about the concept of a growth investor and how that plays out in the middle market space.
Yes, thank you for asking that. Yes, my partners and I were investing in global infrastructure at Lehman Brothers at the time of the financial crisis. And that was the original impetus to start Tiger Infrastructure. But to your question, the original insight for Tiger went like this, and it is what I articulated to my very first investor. And it was this: I want to spin out with my senior team, and we have an extraordinary opportunity. And to oversimplify that opportunity, imagine a white canvas, and to paint the white canvas at the time, this is around 2010, let's call it, at the time, 90 to 95% of the capital in the infrastructure space was dedicated towards core and core plus. It's not far off that today, by the way, but it's less than that. But what I said was that appears tiny little area of infrastructure, which happens to be a massive opportunity like I've never seen in any asset class before, potentially dwarfing private equity. And it is a growth. And further, there are no sophisticated, institutionally backed private equity firms that are driving hard after it. I want to be the first. And that was the first thesis. The second thesis was, and still is, that, and when I was asked, what makes you think you can capture this opportunity of newer growth infrastructure? And I said, it's very simple, because every free market economy for the last 100 years has created tailwinds for, whether by innovation or by regulation, those are really the drivers, either by innovation or regulation, have driven the need for new infrastructure. And just to give you an example, looking back over the last number of decades of these free market economies always creating tailwinds by innovation or regulation, in the 1970s, there was the deregulation of the airline industry and the advent of environmental legislation in the 1980s, there was a deregulation of railway and trucking. That was, by the way, when computing was being kickstarted. In the 1990s, personal computers become ubiquitous. And hey, there's something called the internet. Talk about innovation, changing the need for new infrastructure. In 2000s, of course, there was the commercialization of the internet. In the 2010s, the Paris Agreement, you know, has driven a lot of the global net zero mind space and emission targets. It's driving the need for new infrastructure. And of course, lately in the 2020s, you've got all this legislation from the Biden administration, the BEAD Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, the Infrastructure Act. My point is that it's always present and there always will be new infrastructure. And the last point that I would make around this is infrastructure as an asset class. It came about unlike any asset class I've ever seen in my decades of being an investment professional, and that is this. It was not driven by real opportunity initially, by real opportunity in the real economy. It was driven by big investors who were looking for an investment product. This is the early 2000s and mid-2000s. They historically low interest rates, zero interest rates, searching for yield, looking for bond substitutes, and they found it in roads, bridges, and tunnels. And sit on it for 20 years and collect a 7% coupon or something like that. And that was the driver of the space. It wasn't energy transition. It wasn't the digital transformation. But that is, back to your original question, that is what we were aiming for, those opportunities driven by those phenomenon in the real economy.
Fantastic. That's a very clear description of how you work at Tiger. And when you talked about the kind of assets of tomorrow and the blue chip companies that you're working with, I really found it very interesting when I was doing my homework ahead of this interview to check in on the portfolio, see the kind of companies that you've been investing in. You know, you've got a very interesting mix of companies in the portfolio. The FBO business, Modern Aviation, which you recently sold a stake to Apollo. The battery storage and renewables business, Zenobi, you sold a stake to KKR, I believe it was. And the deals as well that you've now done with Summit Carbon Solutions for the carbon capture and storage project up in the kind of the Midwest of America. Talk a little bit about how you're attracting those big players, those big infrastructure players into the investments. At what stage do they join you on that journey investing?
We like growth equity writ large. Not just infrastructure, but growth equity in the private equity firmament. We are most typically the first institutional capital in. You'd see that in classic private equity. That is the same for us. The main difference between us and private equity, growth equity, is A, we're looking for infrastructure assets, but B, we're not clubbing up deals as a minority investor with other growth investors. We are control investors. And as an infrastructure investor, especially when you're creating something from scratch or expanding something, you want to be in control. We are the first institutional capital in. And as I said, our goal is to create world-class blue chip core assets that large asset owners want to own. But directly to your question, and we've sold virtually all of our exits have been to very, very large asset owners, just as you have articulated. I think part of the reason that they have been so comfortable owning our assets is first, we're very credible people. We've been around for decades. They know us and trust us. All that is very good. But in everything we do, there is typically, even when we sell, at the time we go to exit, there is still a massive addressable market. There is a big open field. So for example, you mentioned Zenobi. That was a battery storage company that we started in, that we invested in 5 or 6 years ago. We were the first infrastructure fund to build a world scale battery storage company. That's a theme you see in much of what we do. And part of the reason that, and we took it from just a tiny little business in the UK to being a global business. But even in taking it global and even in helping it grow, what KKR undoubtedly saw was still a massive addressable market. There still is. So that's part of what we do, what we're looking for. It's part of our special sauce is we are looking for these big, wide open, big addressable markets with big tailwinds that even in exit are still going to exist and provide the next asset owner comfort that they have an avenue to further growth. So de-risked, less of a complex situation that they take over, but they are indeed looking for that growth. So, and another quick example, modern aviation. I love to talk about modern aviation because, as your listeners will know, Blackstone and GIP, they own the largest collection of FBOs in the United States. KKR, under the brand name Signature. KKR owns the second largest collection of FBOs in the United States under the brand name Atlantic. We came in with nothing except an idea and a team and an understanding that the FBO space was largely fragmented. We saw an addressable market of 500 to 700 FBOs. There might be a couple thousand, but still only 500 or 700 that you'd want. And Signature and Atlantic had kind of cooled their acquisition binge, and we saw the opportunity to be a consolidator. And so we dove in with a world-class team, and we built what is either the third or largest in the country, which we're still an investor in, but we have exited a large portion of that. But again, that with Apollo, what Apollo, undoubtedly one of the things they saw is still just a big opportunity to continue to go after FBOs.
I think that's quite unique about your approach as well, isn't it, Emil, at Tiger? When you're actually staying in these investments, you remain as a co-investor alongside people like Apollo and KKR. You also want to participate in the growth and the future success of these businesses. And I wanted to ask you, taking a step back before that, how do you work in the origination stage of these deals? How does your team operate? Traditionally, you've invested across North America and Europe. I think with FS Bioenergia, you've also got now an investment in Brazil, which is my old stomping ground in Latin America, so very happy to see that. How do you go about origination and which areas do you look for typically to find opportunity?
Glad you asked that, because that is certainly part of what we think of as our special sauce. Again, we were the first growth infrastructure fund. We haven't seen another growth infrastructure fund, though some now are doing things similar to us or trying to do things similar to us. But my point is that by virtue of being a growth fund, and this, by the way, this was an unintended consequence of me starting this fund complex, is that we are known, and now we are known and have been known as the growth investor in infrastructure, which means that we are getting from all of the financial intermediaries, all entrepreneurs and innovators, we are getting, amongst many other deal folk, we are getting early stage windows into the infrastructure of tomorrow. And 95% of it is worthless and we wouldn't touch it, right? Much of it is just too early stage, too risky, all that kind of stuff. However, by being the growth guy, you attract these growth plans, and those growth plans are your window into where the world is headed. So for example, when my partners and I started Tiger Infrastructure, EV charging wasn't on the agenda. However, very quickly we began to see these plans. It was the Wild West. There was nothing of institutional quality. However, we knew there was going to be something very interesting in that. And so what we do, to your point about origination, is that once we develop conviction around a new pathway, a new vertical, a new opportunity, we deploy teams to go very deep and do very extensive research on these. And we're doing them literally right now on five or six areas. I'm happy to talk about them. But it is that deep work which informs us, like in battery storage. Battery storage wasn't on the original radar screen. However, we began to see early plans. For 3 years, we studied it, and we finally executed with Zenobia. But that's an important, that kind of seeing, getting a glimpse of the future, deploying teams against that thesis, whether sometimes we shelve it because we decide it's not worth pursuing. That's a part of our origination machine. And we have, in our world, since we're first institutional capital in, quite often the sellers, they're looking for primary capital. They're not looking for something to sell, right? They're looking, which means they're looking for a partner. They're not auctioning something. They're looking who's a partner who really understands how to manage growth, who has done it before. We have a real, I can say this comfortably, my partners in my firm, we have real skill set expertise in having done this for over a decade. This is not for people to jump in and kind of try to do it. I always make that point when I talk to people. That's a part of our origination machine.
Excellent. I can imagine you as a kind of middle market infrastructure shark tank or something like this, auditioning all of these companies coming through the door.
Which is not to say, sometimes I do have to say this, which is not to say that we are not venture capitalists. We are not about VC risk. We're not about taking technology risk. We are about really limited commodity risk. In everything we do, we're not looking to find a business plan that has the quote unquote characteristics of infrastructure. And so maybe we can fit it into our portfolio. We're looking for infrastructure. We're looking for essential services, real assets with high and defensible moats, inflation protected in everything we do. We're trying to stay true to an infrastructure mandate, and our investors pretty much expect that.
And in terms of your mandate, looking through some of the documents that we have on our Infologic database, I saw some reports about some of the performance of Tiger's funds, and I think you're producing somewhere around mid-teens net IRRs for the business. You also have quite an interesting strategy with co-investments, I believe. A lot of the LPs can co-invest alongside, outside of the fund structure. Can you tell me a little bit about that? And also about the capital structure and the stack that you like to implement with the businesses.
Yes.
I think when we spoke before, Emil, you said that you don't like to over-leverage the assets too much.
Yes.
So maybe you could talk a little bit about those elements of the transactions and how that fits into the growth strategy.
Yes, leverage is anathema to a growth strategy. If you were sitting across, not from me, but to a fellow who ran a growth equity PE complex, you wouldn't expect them to have a lot of leverage in their program, and we don't either. I think writ large across all of our portfolio companies, if you added them up, we'd be 20%, LTV, something like that. Leverage is not a driver of return for growth. And the corollary to that is that solvency is not one of our top three risks, right? A core infrastructure buyer is going to lever something up 70, 80, 90%. They take purchase price risk. They take leverage risk. It's all fine. It's just not what we do. The leverage, to your point, how we think about debt. And to your question about co-investment, co-investment is a very important piece of our puzzle. And I think of roughly a third of our AUM today is via a co-investment. And that is because with a growth strategy, really what you want to do, if you're going to lead from strength, if you're going to be the strongest partner to a potential entrepreneur, you want to be able to tell them that you can fund their entire business plan. So they don't think, oh, I'm just raising a little bit of capital now, but I got to be in capital formation mode a year from now. They really want to hear you can fund their, typically, they want to, that you can fund their business plan. And so we like to do that, or we like to be able to articulate that. And co-investment is a piece of that puzzle of us leading with strength.
I'd love to talk a little bit about Summit Carbon Solutions now. It's such an interesting space. Everybody's talking about energy transition, which is a key part of your investment thesis at Tiger. How does carbon capture storage work in this business? I think they're operating out of the Dakotas, is that correct? And Montana?
Not Montana, but I'll walk you through it. Okay, so I'm glad you asked that question because it is fascinating. And again, I mentioned that the theme that you will see is that quite often we are the first in terms of heading into a new sub-vertical. And I believe that we are a first here in that we are backing a team that is building the largest carbon capture and sequestration pipeline in the world. And that is a function, again, of our origination strategy, where years prior, we saw the need for carbon capture and sequestration. One of our theses behind this is the following, and it really is powerful. They're one of the largest consulting firms in the world, has advised us that in order for the U.S. to hit its Paris Accord goals, that 30 to 40% of the carbon reduction must come from carbon capture. And the world is just warming up on this. So this is, again, this is like everything we do. There is a massive addressable market here. And even if this large consulting firm is wrong by half, it's just a kind of breathtaking what will happen in terms of carbon and sequestration. So that's really the big tailwind behind what we're doing. The second big tailwind is that there has been a longstanding government subsidy, if you will, that allows for, that will pay you for a ton of CO2 sequestered. And that actually, that subsidy was actually enhanced through the recent round of legislation out of Congress in the last couple of years. And that's a subsidy that we think is rock solid and where there is massive bipartisan support on a go-forward basis. That's what we're doing there. It is the first. It is hand on heart. It is innovative. We will sell this eventually to a very large asset owner, and there will be many, many more of these to come.
How big is the project in Meal? I've seen figures cited well over $1 billion for this investment when the greenfield infrastructure. I understand that Summit also had some investment from TPG Rise, Climate Continental Resources, and SK, Korean conglomerate. How big is the project and what's the timeline for construction and for development and all the rest?
Yes. Well, the project in its infancy, when we created this company, we and another group called Summit Ag out of Iowa, some very enormously capable investors and with whom we have invested before quite successfully. We created the company before we brought in all those investors that you articulated. Yeah, you're right. We did bring in all of those investors and we brought them in to the tune of a little over $1 billion. So you're right about that in terms of equity. But in terms of the project size, the original size of the project was around $5 or $6 billion, but it's been expanded. And the reason it's been expanded is that the folks over at BlackRock were at one point considering building something similar. It's different, but it's similar. And they were considering building a project that they decided not to do. There's many, many reasons for that. It's not worth going into. But the good news for us is that their largest customers on that pipeline immediately or very quickly came over to us. And so by virtue of those new customers, we've expanded the size of the project, we've expanded the volume, and the additional volumes are more accretive on a gross margin basis just by virtue of economics. That's the size of the project. There are a couple of permits that are left to be had. I believe 70 to 75% of the rights of way are done. In many jurisdictions, you can get to those levels and then there's this thing called eminent domain where you can get the rest. And that is well underway. And all the sum and substance of all of that is we should be, their current expectation is that this will be ready for service no later than 2027, maybe 26.
All right. We look forward to seeing it. It's another kind of technology that, again, is at the forefront of the energy transition. As you said, it's certainly something that you're pioneering in this sense. I'd like to think about some of the other opportunities that are maybe not ready for prime time. What else is your team investigating? What do you think, Emil, will be the infrastructure that perhaps we're going to be seeing 5 years from now that is still in its infancy at this stage?
Okay, great. I'm really glad you asked that question because that's where we live and breathe. And we believe we have a window into the next wave. We have teams studying these kinds of things. We're deep into various potential investments that could exploit these trends. And so I need to be kind of careful because it's a little bit of our special sauce here. But just to give you a flavor, sustainable air fuel is a massive market opportunity. I think there's 100 billion gallons of fuel that's used annually. I think less than 0.5% of that is made up by sustainable air fuel. There is massive demand from basically all the large carriers who see where the world is headed and want a source of SAF, sustainable air fuel. And we have been studying this for a while. We've been working with some people for a while, and we feel we have a bead on the key elements of creating a project like that, like this. And the key elements, it's really threefold. Again, it's not recreating the wheel. It's like every project in history. There's feedstock, there's the actual plant, and there's offtake. And we feel like we have a strong conviction around each of those pieces of the puzzle. Another kind of looking into the future, it's hard to overstate the impact that AI is having on the digital space most and will have. Literally, it's just in the first inning and will have, especially in and around data centers. And it's, as you probably know well, it's going to be a driver of real innovation around cooling, around the reconfiguration of data centers, and around the source and reliability of power. And there, it's kind of actually, it's mind-boggling what is going on in the space. And, you know, when the world goes from CPUs to GPUs, you know, these things that NVIDIA is creating, that's going to change things dramatically. The big hyperscalers, the Facebooks, Amazons, Apples, Microsofts, They are hungry to secure reliability of power. Many of them are negotiating, not only building dozens of data centers globally, but negotiating for power in ways you've never heard of before. I think 4% of U.S. power is used to power data centers or similar activity today. That is going to go up dramatically. It has massive implications for the grid. It has massive implications for grid reliability. And so it's just hard. It's my long-winded way of saying it's just hard to overstate the change. And the punchline there is the data center space is being re-rated as we speak. I don't know where it will end up. I don't know where valuations will end up. But there should be some dramatic impact here, and we're deep into it. One last, I'm just trying to give you a flavor. On a global basis, I've said this to others, and it's a pretty profound statement, and it sounds profound, but it really is the truth. None of the targets that people are aiming for electric vehicles are going to be hit. Not at the sovereign level, not at the state level. They're just not going to be hit. And there's many, many, many reasons. You've actually seen some slowdown in growth of demand recently. It's not really that. But that's a thing. It's about the world right now is just short in a profound and substantial way the critical minerals necessary to achieve those targets. And, you know, whether it's copper, lithium, nickel, cobalt, graphite, kind of the list goes on. Now, some of the recent legislation out of the Biden administration has attempted to create subsidies that incentivize the onshoring of critical minerals, the development of critical minerals. And my point in saying all this is, you know, you ask what's coming. That's definitely coming. Now, as an infrastructure player, we're not, you know, on the value chain of critical minerals, which go from mining on the one hand all the way to manufacturing batteries on the other. We're not going to do either of those. We're not going to be mining. We're not going to be manufacturing batteries, but the supply chain, distribution, think of the analogy of midstream for critical minerals, right? There is an opportunity. We are spending a lot of time on that.
That's interesting. And that's something that somebody described to me once as logistics 2.0. I was at a presentation when they talked about how modern day warehouses don't have the right weight bearing capabilities for sophisticated robotic infrastructure. A lot of the rooftops are not necessarily strong enough to hold solar panels and other installations that you might need for that kind of future logistics or logistics 2.0. So that's something that's definitely very high on our list of priorities of sectors that we're seeing investors engage with.
Indeed. Look for the decarbonization of virtually everything. If you look out at a modern airport and look at all the trucks going around, the fueling vehicles, the catering vehicles, you know, fast forward 10 years and you've got a massively electrified group of rolling stock and transportation assets. Again, just another in this big opportunity set.
Emil, looking forward in another sense, you mentioned the Biden administration and the legislation that they've put into place in the last few years. some of your projects, I'm sure, and some of your companies will benefit from some of that legislation, like perhaps the Summit Carbon Solutions benefiting from the 45Q tax credits. I'm interested, you know, given your previous position with the Treasury, you were the Deputy Secretary of the Treasury from 2005 to 2007, working under Secretary Snow and Paulson. You must have an interesting perspective now being back in the private sector, having had that public sector experience. Without going into too much detail on the election itself coming up in November, how do you see the macroeconomic situation today? And I'm particularly interested with a view to the election, how you think that the infrastructure-related legislation we've seen under the Biden administration is going to play with electors ahead of the November election.
Thank you for asking that. Yeah, actually, and a little side note is I spent my career in and around private equity, and I was a general before I went into the Treasury. I was largely a generalist. But then, you know, 2005, this is going on 20 years ago, I just by a complete coincidence, I was given an oversight responsibility for something called the U.S. Office of Critical Infrastructure, which is and was a massive investment in U.S. infrastructure in remarkable ways, mostly around security as a response to September 11th. How do we secure where there once was, where the world woke up that there could be a low-cost, high-concept attack that could do such damage? What does that mean for the grid? What does it mean for pipelines? What does it mean for ports? What does it mean for financial infrastructure, right? And so that's really where the light bulb went off for me about the growth opportunity. That's the origins of how I came into the space nearly 20 years ago. And to your point, on the macro, you asked two questions, one on the macro issue, one on, you know, it's the impact of infrastructure-related legislation, how it might impact the election. And we don't have a lot of time, and you said not a lot of detail, but I'll say this, it's the most complex macro picture I've ever seen in my professional life. And it is not only because of global chaos, it is not only because of global energy transition and energy insecurity and energy volatility. It is not only because there are forces at play that would love to see the dollar no longer as the world's reserve currency. Talk about something that's really destabilized. I don't see that in the near term, but let's just be eyes wide open to the fact that there are folks who would really like to see that. And then you get into the kind of global currency and interest rate environment, right? You throw in inflation, you throw in the global monetary policy folks' reaction to that, most namely the Fed. They're really complex. Like, for example, I've never seen the yield curve inverted. I think it was a couple of years ago, 90%. This happened, by the way, when I was at the Treasury. I think it was before the Great Recession. Yield curve inverted. We studied it with the Federal Reserve, with the chairman on down. I think 90% of inverted yield curves in the history of this country have resulted in recessions. They're all for a bunch of reasons, which are not worth going into now. Yield curve inverted, and 90% of the financial community thought the U.S. was going to head into a recession. Obviously, the opinions have changed right now. There's still a small group, including Jamie Dimon over J.P. Morgan. He still sees a recession. But my point is, talk about uncertainty in how people are seeing our economic world right now. It's just really complex, and it's really uncertain. And so then in terms of the election, I don't think in terms of all the legislation, by the way, that legislation has been a piece of the inflation puzzle. That was, you know, if you take a giant step back, there was a lot of industrial policy going on there. And whether you agree with the policy or not, trillions of dollars are being poured into such industrial policy. And that's on the backs of trillions of dollars of pandemic cash that got poured. That, you know, talk about market distortion and complexity. That's, you know, that's a big piece of the driver, the complexity. But punchline, not to oversimplify it, I don't see that legislation as really impacting the election significantly. I don't think it hits people so much in their day-to-day lives. Yes, price of gas has been really high. Yes, you know, you go to California and you see the cost of electricity as significantly above the rest of the country. But I don't think the folks in California are saying, golly, all those renewable subsidies are making me pay more in my monthly bills. It's kind of the opposite for California. So I just think there are bigger issues at play in this election than, you know, than the 45Q for carbon and for rural fiber subsidies, which we're trying to exploit for our investors, and further renewable subsidies and critical mineral subsidies. I just don't think they hit people where they live. So
right. That might not swing the needle for Joe Public.
I don't think so. I could go on chapter and verse about what I think will swing the needle, move the needle, but I don't think that will.
Okay, excellent. Well, that could be a whole new podcast, so we'll have to invite you back in, Neil, for another episode. But I thought this was a very insightful discussion. I thought it was really interesting to hear about Tiger's philosophy and Tiger's strategy in the investments that you're making. So without any further ado, thank you very much for attending Crossroads, Emil, and we look forward to hearing from you again soon.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
And thank you to all our listeners. I'm Jonathan Carmody, America's managing editor at InfraLogic. Thank you everyone for listening. You can download this episode anywhere you get your podcasts.